This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, the Micronesian president says Australia's catastrophic summer of bushfires should motivate the government here to do more to reduce its carbon emissions. Also coming up, a family tragedy that's become an all too familiar story in the Pacific. A family loses eight members in what was meant to be a family holiday boat trip in Bougainville. And a modern day slavery case involving Samoan workers goes to trial in New Zealand. And one expert tells us it shows just how many Pacific Islanders are vulnerable to trafficking.
Unfortunately, it's not something that's likely to go away. People do find themselves in these situations where they are vulnerable, and people prey on vulnerable people because they know that there's opportunity to do so.
And more on that story and more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Graham. First, though, Indonesia's president has wrapped up a visit to Australia in which he made an historic speech to the country's parliament and called for both countries to do more to address climate change, to stop terrorism and improve human rights. But activists say that his government's own record on human rights, especially in the restive provinces of Papua and West Papua, wasn't highlighted. In the lead-up to his visit, they had been urging the Australian government to bring the issue up with President Joko Widodo, but his visit was largely focused on trade, coming just days after his parliament ratified a free trade deal with Australia. Now, among those who had been making those calls was Veronica Komen. She's an Indonesian lawyer who remains in self-exile here in Australia because she's wanted by police in Indonesia, where she's accused of inciting the often violent pro-independence protests that broke out in the two Papua provinces last year. I spoke with her earlier.
I think the speech between two countries just reflect how both trying to gloss what's happening, especially in Indonesia's side, because I think that no matter how good Indonesia's international diplomacy is, that West Papua will always be the pebble in the shoes. It's very disappointing that, again, economic interest is prevailed over human rights issues.
We don't, though, know, of course, what discussions were had privately. As I said, it certainly wasn't mentioned or discussed in the speech to Parliament, but also other issues that are quite contentious, like the South China Sea and China, what it's doing in that area, were not discussed as well. So perhaps this issue was brought up, but done so privately.
Yeah, I still try to be optimistic and believe that way. Yes, definitely.
Now, I understand activists did hand over a letter that had a list of people's names who you all claim are political prisoners, as well as another list of people who have died in one of the areas that's had some of the worst violence. What was the point of doing that?
We handed the data over to Jokowi because, like, in the beginning of his first term, he released five West Papua political prisoners. But right now, at the beginning of his second term, we now have 57 people being charged with treason. There are other political prisoners, but non-treason charges. So we are highlighting these treason charges because they are facing life imprisonment and they are peaceful activists. So we were wondering whether, did Jokowi actually know about this, you know, that now we have this many political prisoners. Did Jokowi know that this military operation taking place in Duga already, the civilian death toll is already 243? Did he know? So now we already made sure that it was, the data was handed over to Jokowi directly. We hope that as any decent human being would reconsider such a move.
You are, as you've said, in exile here in Australia. You're wanted in Indonesia, accused of provoking unrest in Papua and West Papua last year. What is the update on your situation? Will you return to Indonesia to face those charges?
At this stage, I cannot return home yet, but I definitely want to return home when I can. But I still cannot see me going back because the government's attitude approach towards West Papua is still not changing. We can see it by an indicator whereby there are still these many political prisoners charged with treason, they're still behind bars. My case is just one of so many cases. My case is one of many of those political cases. So as long as these people are still behind bars, you can tell that there's an indicator where I can return yet.
Given you are here in Australia, do you think that your case was discussed by the President and the Australian Prime Minister, Scott Morrison?
I don't know, but I really wish that the other cases are prioritized, because I still feel that I am pretty privileged for being able to be in Australia and still expressing my opinion and advocating for West Papua.
One of the other things that we noted from the President's speech to Parliament was his mention several times of the Pacific, where he wanted to see Australia and Indonesia work more together. It's no surprise and not new that both Australia and Indonesia have been showing a greater interest to work and have a presence in the Pacific. But of course, the Pacific countries like Vanuatu are where the West Papua independence movement gets its greatest support. So what did you read into the President's remarks of mentioning the Pacific several times while he was here in Australia?
Yeah, I think that Indonesia has been very interested in Pacific's region since, I would say, like particularly these past 2 years. And I think it's definitely because of West Papua. Like Indonesia established aid last year for Pacific. It's very problematic, I think, because Indonesia is still receiving funding from other countries. But Indonesia is trying so hard to help, quote, like help, Pacific. I think it's most likely because of West Papua, definitely.
It's the Indonesian lawyer who remains in self-exile here in Australia, Veronica Coleman, speaking with me earlier. Well, the President of the Federated States of Micronesia says that Australia's catastrophic summer of bushfires should motivate the government here to do more to reduce its carbon emissions and act on climate change. The bushfire crisis of the past few months has certainly ignited some heated debate here in Australia, and some of the country's top scientists recently declared that Australia needs to put long-term plans in place for more extreme weather events and human-induced climate change. Now, President David Panuelo is one of many Pacific leaders who've called out on larger nations like Australia to do more with their climate policies. So in light of the summer that we've seen, this is the question that I put to him. You've been outspoken before on Australia's stance on coal and its carbon emissions targets, etc. Have you been watching the recent debate here in Australia on climate change in the aftermath of the terrible summer of bushfires that we've had? And is this somewhat of a told-you-so moment for you?
You know, I have been watching the news, listening to the debate, and I've been learning a great deal, you know, in that process. First of all, on January 6, 2020, I declared on behalf of the nation that the Australian bushfires are a humanitarian crisis, because when people lose their homes and their livelihood, that's a crisis. And Australia is one of FSM's partners, friends and allies. And so Australia's pain is Micronesia's pain. Our world is better. A world when people listen to each other, respect each other, and show each other love. Australia shows the FSM love, and the FSM shows Australia love. That said, you know, of course, love cannot stop fires, but sound environmental protection policies can. I encourage our Australian partners and friends to join the Pacific community in embracing the fight against climate change. I know Australia's policies have been still, you know, relying on coal and all of that. But like every country, I encourage Australia to move on in an expeditious manner towards cleaner forms of energy. Climate change must require all of us countries together for it to be successful.
Now, one of the sticking points for Australia at the moment, it will be whether this year it develops and then adopts a net zero carbon emissions target by the year 2050. That was something that Prime Minister Scott Morrison signed up to when he signed a statement at last year's Pacific Leaders Summit in Tuvalu, saying that Australia would also produce a 2050 strategy this year. But his commitment to that has so far been vague. But in recent days, the Australian government has in fact confirmed that it is now assessing what emissions targets it will pursue beyond 2030. Some of Australia's closest allies have already announced their plans for a net zero carbon emissions by 2050, like the United Kingdom, Canada and Japan. And Australia's Finance Minister, Matthias Cormann, has now confirmed that it is under consideration here as well.
We want our policy agenda to be environmentally effective and economically responsible, and we'll make those judgments in time before COP26 in Glasgow later this year.
Australia's Finance Minister Matthias Cormann speaking yesterday. Now, those comments came after I had actually spoken with the Federated States of Micronesian President David Panuelo at the weekend. But nonetheless, he has said that reviewing policies isn't enough in his books. He's urging Australians to pressure their politicians.
As a Pacific Island country that relies so much on our environment, our sustenance comes from the environment. Maybe most countries, their relationship is on the supermarket shelves, when you go buy your food. Whereas here in Pacific, we go catch our fish a lot. And I've had that experience growing up with my father, with my siblings, catching fish and then farming in our land. And we see the direct relationship with the what we grow on land and what we catch. And so that is why environment is so precious. And so I would say that, of course, that's not enough. If reviewing policies is definitely not enough. And, Prime Minister Morrison is a good friend. He's a great leader. And I know he's trying to balance what Australia must do with your policies of energy. But the Australian people are the ones that elected him. I think you folks need to speak. The search for truth is what's important. In the Pacific, we look at consensus, and consensus normally would reach a truth. And so if the Australian people find that the truth is that climate change really is happening and matters, Catherine, then the Australian people must demand what the leadership should reflect in their decision making. This is real. It's based on science, and it's impacting our livelihood. And so as a true friend of the Pacific Island countries, I really do hope that Australia, yours is probably to maintain a comfort zone. Ours is maintaining our survival and livelihood.
But don't you think in Australia too, perhaps that has changed now, as demonstrated by the bushfires that we've seen this summer? Experts say that there are going to be more of them with climate change getting worse in coming years.
I think that in itself should exacerbate the situation by itself, speaking for itself and to implore upon the leadership. And so I think the situation that Australia has just recently faced or continue to face with the devastation of the bushfires, I think that's a weapon in itself to really show the light that if we don't respect Mother Earth by giving back more than we're taking from it, by respecting it, then it can lash out. And that's what happens in terms of natural disasters that we face in the Pacific, including Federated States of Micronesia. So wish Australia the best. You're a good friend. And, our sympathies goes out to those that have lost lives and property. Let's be together in this fight against climate change. And the Australian population and citizens must also rise to say this is what we demand, because the recent bushfires is an example of what can happen with climate change.
This is David Panuelo, the President of the Federated States of Micronesia. Well, it was meant to be a family Christmas trip by boat from Booker in Bougainville to the remote and very low-lying Carteret Islands. But 30 days later, they were found drifting at sea with only 4 of the 12 passengers still alive. It is the latest tragedy in a story that's become all too familiar for many countries in the Pacific, where boat travel is the main form of transport. Our reporter Evan Wasuka has been following the story. Evan, as I said, this is an all too familiar scenario. What happened with this group?
Well, Catherine, it is a very tragic story, and it happened just before Christmas when a group of 12 people, all family members, including children, traveled by boat from the town of Booker in Bougainville to the Carteret Islands. It's a 120-kilometer journey, but their boat capsized in heavy seas. One person drowned, but the group managed to turn the boat over and get it floating again. But that was just the start of the ordeal that would see them drift in open sea. And when they were finally picked up, more than 30 days later by a passing ship near New Caledonia, by that time only 4 family members were still alive. Papua New Guinea's High Commissioner in the Solomons, John Balavu, organized their transfer up to Honiara for medical treatment.
The ship that picked them up did a wonderful job nursing them until they were brought to Honiara. But still, they were weak, dehydrated, and there were sores on their skins that due to exposure to sunlight.
That's PNG's High Commissioner John Balavu. He's been spending time with the survivors in Honiara and listened to their accounts of how they survived at sea.
They were surviving on rainwater, and the coconuts, old coconuts that float by, sometimes they would try to catch fish, and if they were fortunate, yeah, they would catch some fish. There was something mentioned by the survivor, I don't know what is it, but he was saying Tara, you know, this is some kind of suits that you find in the ocean. So they're just like bamboo suits. You just take it, peel it, and then chew on it.
Pretty incredible story of survival. Evan, what happens to them now, though? They've been in the Solomon Islands in hospital.
Well, Catherine, the good news is that the three survivors are now out of hospital. That includes a 10-year-old girl. There's still a young man still left in hospital for treatment. While they are now safe in Honiara, their journey home isn't yet guaranteed, as PNG officials say they don't have the budget for repatriation. Now, the owner of the boat, who's among the survivors, is looking to sell the boat to help pay for their return home.
Thank you for that update. That's our reporter, Evan Wasuka.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, the death toll from the coronavirus outbreak has now passed 900, and the number of confirmed cases has exceeded 40,000. The World Health Organization is warning the world is not prepared to deal with a possible pandemic in the future. While this novel coronavirus is not considered to be a pandemic at the moment, public health experts say that lessons certainly need to be learned from it. As Sarah Sedgie reports.
Health authorities have been on high alert trying to stop the coronavirus from spreading further, and it's got them thinking about the real threat of future pandemics.
On the whole, the world is not well prepared to respond to a pandemic, and so I think that we as a global community should also be taking this opportunity to think about what we could be doing in the future.
Epidemiologist Dr. Caitlin Rivers is from the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security in Baltimore. She's encouraged by the global response to the coronavirus outbreak. And while it's not considered a pandemic, she thinks it shows more can be done globally to be ready if one did surface. And she's not alone. The World Health Organization says too often when outbreaks settle down, the world moves on and doesn't do enough to prevent the next one.
This has been described as a cycle of panic and neglect, in that we often put preparedness aside until there's a serious event, and then we sort of panic and wish that we had mechanisms and funding in place, but we didn't take the opportunity when we had it. I think that actually the world has come a very long way in improving preparedness since the 2003 SARS epidemic. So that's kind of a nice counterpoint. But in general, we could be doing more. And I think it really comes down to funding.
Professor Sharon Lewin is the director of the Doherty Institute for Infection and Immunity in Melbourne. She's also the lead investigator at the Australian Partnership for Preparedness Research on Infectious Disease Emergencies. She says there's a lot we can learn from the outbreak.
Lessons around data sharing and a global aligned response. I think there's lessons around stigma and discrimination, which always happens with infectious diseases. And there's no reason that certain ethnic groups should be stigmatised or countries.
She says a lot of work has been done in Australia and around the world in the last 5 years to prepare for outbreaks, but more could be done with new pathogens emerging.
It is definitely becoming more frequent. Over the last two decades, we've seen hundreds of new pathogens. Big ones have been SARS, MERS, swine flu, Zika virus, Ebola.
And most emerging pathogens are ones that can be spread from animals to humans. Dr. Caitlin Rivers.
Although we did not know that this new coronavirus existed, we didn't foresee it jumping into humans. It's just one of a great many viruses that are out there in the world. And I don't know that there's really much we can do to prevent them from making an appearance.
So we can't stop them from jumping that animal-human barrier, but we can invest in vaccines and being prepared.
Absolutely. And surveillance, even just knowing that a new virus is around, is very helpful because then we can move against it. Whereas if it really circulates in the population undetected, it can get some momentum and get going, and then it's much harder to control.
Dr. Caitlin Rivers, an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins University, Sarah Sedgie reporting there. The legal expert says that many Pacific Islanders who travel to New Zealand and also Australia for low-skilled work are vulnerable to being trafficked. The comments come as a major slavery case involving 13 Samoan workers has been brought to trial in New Zealand. Dr. Jane Lindley is the expert. She says such stories are common, but that there are many obstacles that prevent victims from raising the alarm with authorities in the first place. Reporter Priyanka Srinivasan on the story for us. Priyanka, tell us a little bit more about this case in New Zealand firstly.
So this trial involves Samoan national Joseph Matamata. He's a 65-year-old New Zealand resident. Now, he's been charged with trafficking and slavery in relation to 13 Samoan workers who were brought to work in horticulture across the city of Hawke's Bay in the North Island of New Zealand. He was arrested back in 2018 after a two-year investigation by New Zealand police and immigration authorities. And now details of those investigations are coming out in court. So Crown Prosecutor Clayton Walker told the courts yesterday that Mr. Matamata abused his power as a Maatai chief from Samoa by promising the workers a better life in New Zealand, more pay. But he never actually delivered on these promises. He didn't pay them wages after they arrived.
In other words, the Crown alleges that the representations he made to them about the money were false, and they were made to them to lure them to New Zealand so that he could then take advantage of their labours.
New Zealand's Crown Prosecutor Clayton Walker there. Now, he also told the court yesterday that it's estimated around $400,000 New Zealand dollars, about $380,000 Australian dollars, was withheld from these Samoan workers when they came to the country.
Now, Priyanka, this is not the first case of exploitation that we've heard about, reported about in New Zealand or here on Australian farms as well. In fact, just yesterday we reported the story of around 70 workers, many of them from Tonga, who were being kept in so-called slum-like conditions. And then last year there was another case as well where dozens of workers were being investigated because there was fears that they had been trafficked to Australia from a remote village in Fiji.
Yes, that's right. There have been a number of suspected reports of abuse and exploitation, as you mentioned, of workers brought in from the Pacific to work on Australian and New Zealand farms. I spoke with Jade Lindley. She's a legal expert specializing in transnational crime in the region. She says stories like this one in New Zealand are common, but it's often difficult to get specific details about the cases.
We definitely have seen these kinds of cases before, and some dating back, 10, 15 years ago, in people coming from the Pacific Islands to work in Australia and New Zealand on these kinds of seasonal worker schemes. It's very difficult to know all the details that are happening in these sorts of situations because people are coming intending to work legitimately. But unfortunately, it's not something that's likely to go away either, because these sorts of situations exist where people are needed who don't need a lot of skills. And if the qualifications aren't there and they're only for short-term situations as well, then unfortunately, yes, people do find themselves in these situations where they are vulnerable, and people prey on vulnerable people because they know that there's opportunity to do so.
Dr. Lindley there, speaking from the University of Western Australia, she also told me that there's another obstacle in getting such cases to the courts, and that's the cultural or language barriers that might exist. As was the case in this New Zealand workers' case, the workers were expected to respect their Maatai chief, and it just so happened that this chief demanding respect was also their alleged abuser. So this can really complicate things, as Dr. Lindley told me.
In many of these situations, language is a problem for people who are victims or survivors of trafficking and slavery, where they might not speak the language of country that they're working in. And so therefore they're relying on interpreters who may or may not be providing the full information. In many situations, people might be coming to Australia and they're told to avoid authorities or to fear the authorities. But also they might be coming from countries where the authorities are quite often corrupt, or where they do fear the authorities. Instead of feeling like the authorities are the go-to, they might actually be going out of their way to pervert justice or try not to tell the authorities the information they know. And so they do become unreliable witnesses as well in the courtroom situation.
Dr. Jade Lindley, an expert in trafficking and transnational crime. The reporter there on that story for us was Priyanka Srinivasan. That's all for Pacific Beat this morning. Don't forget, our stories are posted on our website. To find it, just type Pacific Beat and ABC Radio Australia into your search engine, or just find and like the ABC Radio Australia page. I'm Catherine Grau. Have a great day.